7 years, 6 months, and 7 days ago, I pressed publish on episode one of Spaces.
Hello, welcome to Spaces. I'm your host, Demetrius, and I'm here with co-hosts Ali and Jason. This is our maiden voyage, and we'd like to start off with a show description and brief insight into our individual backgrounds. As far as the show, Spaces is a millennial-led podcast focused on discussing all aspects of the building industry. From design and construction to management and economics, we're going to try and cover it all. Jason, Ali, and I have been in our industries for 8 years or more, and we're all different ages, but closer to the leading edge of millennials. So we have a unique understanding of our generation while also having some blend of the previous generation's characteristics.
I launched this show to elevate the understanding of and appreciation for the built environment, pulling back the curtain for both everyday building users and industry professionals. Since that first mic check, we've explored how buildings and cities shape our health, our psyche, and our daily rhythms, and how politics, money, and culture keep reshaping those spaces right under our feet. Over this ride, I've celebrated highs, keeping two businesses afloat, earning awards, buying a home with my wife, and weathered lows, stalled projects, missed family moments, and the loss of a grandparent and parent. Through it all, the podcast remained one of my constants, even with the breaks and extended hiatus from time to time. Every guest has stretched my perspective, opened doors to new corners of the industry, and even sparked real-world collaborations. Keeping Spaces alive hasn't been easy, but the data dots and the occasional message tell me you're out there. To every silent commuter, late-night drafter, and treadmill binger, thank you.
These old ways of reinforcing things, like rebar, become really a hindrance to automated construction methods.
This is where we've gotten us. Like, we've gotten us with lots of chronic health conditions and severe loneliness. And I mean, not to like paint a
Between a bad noise and a good sound. So what it means is basically noise is like, it's a cacophony.
Because energy modeling and performance-based compliance paths are becoming more and more the trend and required, and because green building certification programs are popping up and also becoming more aggressive, there's sort of this
fabricated code and metal framing system for commercial buildings that snaps together on the job site.
And I like to call it Google Maps of planning, where you visualize the property and the project and you get turn by turn directions as to what's possible on that property.
Because you listen, rate, and share, according to Listen Notes, Spaces sits in the top 2.5% of more than 3.5 million podcasts and is heard in at least 126 countries. Your support is the fuel that keeps me going. I hope this show not only meets its mission, but gives you fresh value to pass along. And today, though the feed technically holds 216 uploads, I'd like to welcome you to the official 200th episode. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Spaces, the podcast where we explore the forces that shape our spaces and how they shape us. Thanks for coming back, everybody. Today, in honor of episode 200, we're taking a stroll down memory lane. Yes, the classic clip show. But don't pass on this one. Even though it's a clip show, you'll get some behind-the-scenes commentary and maybe hear a few insights you missed before. But before we roll the highlights, a heartfelt thanks to my former co-hosts, Ali Wolf, Jason Weiner, and Michelle Thrakalchawi. Each of you jumped aboard this adventure, and though career moves, new businesses, and growing families pulled us onto different paths, your voices helped shape what this show is today. Thank you. Now, I've spoken to 113 guests, unpacked nearly 200 distinct topics, and experimented with formats. Yet, the mission has never changed. We'll revisit fan favorite moments and a few of my own, surface powerful insights, spotlight trends we called early, reveal the most downloaded episode, and plenty more. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Hi, Demetrius here. As you may know, Spaces is part of Gable Media, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You may have heard me previously mention the development of a brand new membership platform for Gable Media. Well, it's finally here. You can now sign up to be a member at gablemedia.com/members. And as your first major perk, you gain exclusive access to our continuing education program, including AIA creditworthy courses. That's right. Gable Media is now an official AIA CES provider, and you can get credit for listening to select Spaces episodes. The days of scouring the internet for online courses and running around town for creditworthy presentations are over. I've tried out our program, and it is the most convenient way to get your continuing education credits. Now, this membership tier will be limited, so make sure to go to gablemedia.com/members or just click the link in the show notes to gain access today. Early on in the creation of the podcast, we planned to lean heavily on the three of us as the hosts to research and bring insights from our unique perspective to various topics. Myself from architecture, Ali from economics, and Jason from a construction background. While that eventually evolved, we batched and set out to release the first three episodes at the same time. I nervously scheduled them to publish, threw up my hands, and went on Christmas vacation, trying to forget that my voice would now be out there for the world. On December 17th, 2017, Spaces launched, including episode 3, Smart Cities.
Another concept of a smart city is having housing diversity. So you have a mix of different classes, different types of housing. You can have some detached, some flats, some high-rise, all mixed together. So you get a good mix of people that will live in that community.
And again, if you look at some of the master plans right now, they're doing a pretty good job of mixing up product, mm-hmm. right? So I'm thinking like Five Point, Great Park area, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You got a lot of flats, you got a lot of townhomes, you got a lot of big single family, and they're all relatively across the street from each other.
Yes. And yeah. Daybreak, too. Daybreak's the master plan in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And then you want to pair all of those with having a lot of open space, diverse transportation options. So having, you know, trains, buses, and then soon to be autonomous vehicles is one of the tech jumps that we're going to make when we talk about smart cities.
I think it'll be interesting, right? Because we talk about open spaces and those types of things. That's why it's in Arizona and where else and what other geographies is this in?
Well, Singapore, South Korea, New York.
I guess New York's interesting.
Yeah.
Depending on what part of New York, right? Because when you get into some of these like metropolis type areas, there's no open spaces. Like mm-hmm. you can't do open space because look, God's not making any more land, right? So it is what it is.
Well, you have to think about how you can do it. You can do an open space vertically, or not vertically, but you know, in the air. You just have to plan for it and design it.
It's true, actually.
Well, and that's what I thought was fascinating is as you look at it, there's two ways to really do a smart city, and one is to build on an existing city that's already in place,
right.
And another is to build a city from scratch.
Yeah,
they're going
to
do.
The city, converting an existing city to a smart city is brutal.
Well,
it's so much more expensive to do that, and you got to shut down a city to, you know, get underground and run new lines.
But I think to her point, that'll probably happen.
Yeah,
you know, if it takes off in these other ones where they're going ground up, like you're saying, because I totally agree, to mm-hmm. put in the infrastructure from the beginning as opposed to retrofitting, it's not even close, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe it will go that direction at some point, just like you have redevelopment as it is now. I mean, most of the infill we see is teardowns of whatever and popping it right in the middle of a well-developed city as it is.
Well, yeah. And there's examples of both, because in 2014, Singapore said, we're going to become a smart nation. So they're not even just trying to reform just the city that people know and love. They want to do the whole thing. And so, yes, it was hard that you have to update the infrastructure, but what they started with was putting cameras everywhere And so then they could monitor if you live in a high rise and you threw this stuff out your window, they know who's littering or they know who's smoking when you're not supposed to be smoking. And so they kind of started with the cameras that are then fed into what they call Virtual Singapore. And they have a whole team that sits and uses Virtual Singapore. The data looks at all that. It controls crowds. It controls cleanliness. That's why the city, when you go, is impeccable because...
That's so creepy. Yeah. That's interesting, though, because that's, I mean, that's some of the stuff I like. So take this morning, right? 4 a.m., I'm driving down the street on the way to the gym, and I got stopped at like 3 stoplights. I'm the only effing car on the road. And I'm sitting there looking at it. I'm not going to lie to you. I broke the law twice. Like, I was just like, forget this. Like, there's nobody coming. I'm going, right?
This, but this is just to me, that's schtick, just, coppers.
That's just coppers. What?
I'm all old-timey. Of course, while I was on vacation, I couldn't stay away from my hosting app. I was floored to see the performance. The downloads kept growing, especially for smart cities. We were even getting positive emails and messages. I knew we had something. By the end of season one, I was feeling great about the podcast and its performance. A little too much. Now, I'm a huge fan of talk radio and podcasts, and I thought, hey, these numbers look great, and we have a good following in California. We should have a live event. I approached a local brewery, Four Suns Brewing in Huntington Beach, California, about letting us tour and record an episode on site. The owners and staff were super gracious, but my audience expectations far exceeded reality. While it wasn't the roaring crowd that I had in my mind, a few family and friends came out to support. We had a lot of fun and learned a lot, and maybe introduced a few people that were in a tasting room to the show.
Hello! My name is Demetrius. This is Michelle.
Hey, everyone.
This is Jason.
What's up, guys?
And you're listening to Spaces Podcast live. Welcome to Spaces. For our returning listeners, thank you for coming back. We are live here at Four Suns Brewing in Huntington Beach. So you'll hear a little bit of noise in the background. We got football games, hockey games. Everyone's drinking, having a good time. So we have a good episode set up for you. We'll have the owner come in and sit down for a little interview. And we're going to discuss breweries, the evolution of the industry, speak with our hosts about design and construction considerations when you're building a brewery, and kind of the business and future of breweries. Oh. And we're going to do a little bit of a beer tasting at the end with some trivia. So get your thinking caps on, guys.
At the end, we're already doing a beer tasting.
I don't ever have my thinking cap on.
I've got 5 different beers in front of me.
Slow down. I hope you got a driver. Okay, so today we want to start off. This is our 1-year anniversary, guys, to the date. 12/17, we launched last year, so it's been a year. Wanted to check in with you guys, see how if you were to look back on the year, what would your reflection be on a year of doing this podcast?
I can't believe I'm doing this. Does that count? I think about a year ago, I probably never would have expected to be involved in something like this. To be honest with you,
yeah,
it's been pretty cool.
Yeah,
had a lot of fun doing it. And I think it goes without saying, a lot of props got to go to you. I know we've said it multiple times in the past, but you put a lot of work into this. So it's pretty cool just to be able to show up, literally sit down, and you basically tell us what to do and just to talk, which is, you know, primarily what I'm good at, not setting things up, just coming in and talking. So it's been pretty unreal.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Michelle.
I agree. A year ago, I would not have thought that I'd be here. I remember looking at Allie, who was a friend of mine, was doing this with both of you, and I thought that was really cool. So for the opportunity for me to step in was really, really neat.
So I'm going to go a little bit deeper, and when I, doing the research for this you know, each one of our topics, I kind of came across this underlying thing that I noticed is, you know, in our country, in the United States, nothing ever really happens without two things. effective marketing and government backing. And looking at, you know, how all of our spaces have evolved over time, those are the two common threads that I've seen the entire time. And when you think about, you know, nowadays, the advancement of technology, this is the first time in history that the masses have sort of overpowered those at the top to an extent. The amount of information that's out there and the way that people share information, you can sway a vote really easily nowadays. And when you think about that in specifics to the spaces that we occupy, it's really important to, you know, voice your opinion when it comes to spaces like schools, hospitals, housing, homelessness. There's so much that we can address, and with the power that we have with social media and just email, there's a lot that can be done. So kind of looking back on this year and all the different places, spaces that we've studied and kind of discussed, that's one of the common threads that jumped out to me.
If you're looking for it, that was episode 26, Breweries, which published December 20th, 2018. I encourage you to check out the full episode if you haven't heard it before. For those that don't know, I produce the show and have never had any formal training in audio production. I actually learned audio editing in college, outside of the classroom. As part of a charity competition week called Greek Week, the finale of the events is called Lip Sync. Each campus Greek organization needed to perform to a produced mashup of songs, sound effects, and voiceovers. An older fraternity brother gave me a crash course in Audacity, then handed me the reins. After running it for 4 years, our fraternity walked away with 3 first place trophies in this competition, and I discovered a lifelong love for audio production. Now, fast forward to podcasting, I re-engaged with audio, continued to learn, explore, and introduce more and more techniques along the way. To this day, one of my favorite edits is from our season 2 finale, episode 40, Sports Performance, Training Center, and Mamba Sports Academy, which published December 23rd, 2019. We discuss sports performance training centers, and I actually visited the Sports Academy training facility in Thousand Oaks, California. In the episode, I explored the evolution of training facilities.
Training centers? I gotta go back in time. Sixth century BCE. The earliest known fitness gym is built in Greece. However, after the fall of the Greco-Roman empires, the appreciation and pursuit of a sculpted body was frowned upon until the 1800s. As the appreciation for fitness rekindled, sports medicine and sports science began to take form. Notably, Italian physiologist Angelo Mosso presented his findings on research into muscular fatigue and the relationship between training, strength, and endurance. Relatively quickly, the growing interest in fitness led schools to develop athletic programs, sports viewership reached all-time highs, and televised sporting events came to market. Meanwhile, shortly after World War II, Russia set aim to have the best athletes and soldiers in the world, but techniques were largely unknown for some time. But we'll come back to that later. In sports, toughness has been a revered trait of iconic athletes. Manchester City goalie Bert Trautmann finishing the 1956 FA Cup with a broken neck. Ronnie Lott playing in a 1985 NFL playoff game with a crushed finger that eventually had to be amputated. Or Carrie Strug's iconic vault on a sprained ankle that helped the US gymnastics team win gold in 1996. Television broadcasts promoted this lore to the masses. This unprecedented access made athletes idols, inspiring generations to mimic them. But in 1984, one specific player took sports popularity to another level.
At one guard, and now the noise factor begins to really increase. Here is the man. They call him Mr. Jordan in Chicago. The standing ovation
A 6'6 rookie guard from North Carolina made his debut for the Chicago Bulls, taking the NBA by storm and quickly becoming a global icon. Many remember Jordan's flu game in 1997. He was heralded as the model for toughness in the NBA, playing all 82 games in 8 of his 13 seasons. His brand was one of the first to really impact multiple markets, becoming the guiding star for all other shoe and endorsement deals. His shoes still generated $2.86 billion in revenue for Nike in 2018. Shoes, clothes, video games, trading cards, movies, and TV. Jordan represented the fame and fortune that was possible through sports, and everyone wanted to be like him.
Sometimes I dream that he is me. Got to see that's how I dream to be.
This massive $18 million Gatorade endorsement deal and campaign signified the ever-growing attention on sports and growth as an industry. Aspiring athletes were in a frenzy to be the next Michael Jordan. Behind the TV screen, premier athletes were being introduced to advanced training and medical techniques to help them jump higher, run faster, and hit harder. In 1986, exercise physiologist John Frappier traveled with the United States national team to Russia, where he witnessed Russians incorporating overspeed training and neuromuscular training using electrical stimulation to trick the body into doing more than it had previously thought it could. For example, towing was a technique where athletes held onto the back of a vehicle and attempted to keep up as the speed increased. Their experiments to push the limits of human performance validated some training techniques and standards, and by 1989, Frappier understood these boundaries and established his own metrics to test and developed training programs and early equipment. Collegiate and NFL football players began working with Frappier, reporting tremendous improvements in speed and strength. This training was exclusive, but a strong desire to make it to the professional leagues impacted the pursuit of athletic scholarships, which ultimately reshaped the landscape of youth sports. Today, youth sports are nearly a $17 billion industry, creating a dangerously hyper-competitive pipeline.
We sought out to change youth athletics and how it was trained and how you treated some of the injuries that we're starting to come up in youth athletics that you saw in college or pro sports, you know, severe tendonitis, you know, things that really shouldn't come about in, you know, a 13 or 14 year old. We were seeing those things happen.
That's Dr. Bo Daniels, co-founder and director of integrated sports medicine at Mamba Sports Academy. In the United States today, about 30 million children and teens participate in some form of organized sports. Approximately 3.5 million of them get hurt annually playing sports or participating in recreational activities, and overuse injuries are responsible for nearly half of their sports injuries. Competitiveness and a lack of understanding of proper training has led children to specialize in one sport from a young age, playing year-round and overexerting themselves in many cases.
That edit still gives me goosebumps today. Now, if you caught it, the facility was briefly named Mamba Sports Academy after Kobe Bryant's nickname, Black Mamba, who's one of my favorite players, and had bought into the ownership of the program. Now, I don't remember if I mentioned this in the episode or in a subsequent recording, but while I was there recording, I was suddenly being rushed out by one of the partners because Kobe was about to show up for an event that was being moved to the facility last minute. I thought my life was leading up to this moment. I might actually get to meet Kobe Bryant. So I slow walked and did everything I could to kind of hang around and see if I could meet him, but it didn't work out. I had to leave the property before he arrived. Now, after a few years of podcasting, I tested a short format version of the show called Express, which allowed me to produce tighter, more frequent, meat and potatoes kind of episodes for listeners with less time. for one of my express guests, I cherry-picked from the Arquette Detailed podcast, digging deeper into a specific technology called Power over Ethernet, or PoE. Published on October 26, 2022, I spoke with Hannah Walker, Chief Operating Officer at Sinclair Digital, discussing innovative building energy systems, energy storage, digital electricity, and power over Ethernet.
Technology is.
So PoE is one of the technologies that we deploy a lot. It's one of our very core technologies that we focus on. So it stands for power over Ethernet. So we're taking Ethernet cables, standard Ethernet cables that you use for cameras, to power access points, to power your IP phone, your desk. And we're powering, we're using that same cable and same infrastructure to now power other things in the building. So things I'm talking about is the lighting. So instead of having typical MC cable going to lights, now we have Ethernet cables, motorized window treatments. You know, we're working with some of our partners to manufacture HVAC units and televisions on PoE. So a typical television, you already have to drop one Ethernet and you have to bring one power circuit. Now, or soon, you can do one Ethernet cable for power and data both. And we want to do that same thing for basically everything in the entire building.
Wow. Are there any limitations to the PoE technology?
Yeah, so the typical limitations that go around PoE is its power over Ethernet is considered class 2, which means that it's low voltage. So to qualify as low voltage, it has to be below 60 volt DC, and it has to be below 100 watts of power. So a typical, they call it PoE++ now, because it started, you know, traditional PoE is only 15 watts, and then it went to 30, and then it went to 60, and now it's at 90, which is really going to be the cap, because now we're hitting that, you know, 100 watt limitation. So anything over 100 watts is out of the realm of power over Ethernet. That's when you start to look at other types of low voltage DC systems that can power those things, but can peak higher than 100 watts. Another limitation is distance limitation of 325 feet from your endpoint. So you have to consider that when you're laying out your infrastructure, how far away are devices, how far away can I be from them? And those are the two main limitations. It's the power and the distance.
Pro tip. If you're an architect looking for continuing education, that episode and a few other of Spaces are approved by AIA for continuing education credits. If you go over to gablemedia.com, that's GABLmedia.com, you can find more info and get those credits once you listen to the episode and take the exam. Now, I've had some amazing guests over the years, from CEOs to popular industry influencers and designers and team leaders behind globally known projects and innovative products and processes. But I gather this next episode is one of your favorites because the downloads surged quickly and sustained for quite a while. It's State of Architecture. The guest was Jaron Lubin, partner at Softy Architects.
Keeping us from working together. It's interesting. If we work with a lot of other architecture firms, like I said, that are phenomenal designers. And I love asking this question of like, what's keeping us from working together? And it is about finding kind of common ground, common goals. I think that one of the places, like this is what I said before. This is like not weird for me to say, like in Singapore, So in Singapore, we note that there's an interrelationship between the design profession and the policymakers that is quite interesting in creating an environment that encourages more collaboration, mm-hmm. and that the common goals that are set by the government agencies and planning authorities, they set the scene for architects to work both individually and together to create a pretty wonderful city setting. And it's all about these planning agencies setting guidelines and incentives and organizational structures first that creates the playground for all of the designers and inventive thinkers to come in and innovate and do their thing.
Yeah.
So this is a very different model than a developer or an open competition coming to an individual and saying, I have specific interests in a specific individual thing, an individual project. Because when you work with a planning agency, you're talking about like you're part of the whole.
Yeah, it's more of an idea rather than purely a profit incentive.
Yeah, and you know, it's not only that, you're not limited in that world by the typical shortlist that we see for every single project. So like, if you want to do a museum these days and you look at the shortlist, it's like the same five architects in every shortlist.
Yeah.
And in a world where the planning groundwork is there, the incentives, the kind of guidelines, it really makes for a much more collaborative and almost like democratic environment where you don't have to be a shortlisted type star architect to create great buildings, great places. You're participating within an environment that allows you to communicate with the whole profession and kind of work together and kind of spin off ideas in a kind of more communal manner.
That chat with Jaron was a highlight for me. Reaching out, I felt like I was swinging for the fences on this one, fully prepared for a no. I actually approach a lot of guests that way, yet I'm constantly surprised by how willing people are to share their time and knowledge. If you're hesitating to email that, quote, unreachable contact or to start that ambitious project, take this as your green light. Reach out and swing big. And finally, the most downloaded episode of Spaces to date is part of the series that I experimented with called Evolution of Architecture. This three-part series, as you'd expect, explores the evolution of architecture throughout history. But I invited five different architects to share their insights into different aspects of its evolution. Chris Preck from Preck to discuss the state of architecture, define what an architect does, highlight societal concerns for architects to address, and explore architecture's relevance to the public.
Well, architecture was always defined by style, right?
Yeah.
It always had some rules of beauty, some systems to build, but the evolution always most of the times came in steps, in big contrast to the previous style. So, for example, the Baroque was very different than the Renaissance, and the Moderne quit with everything that happened before. So it always came in big steps, very in contrast to our own evolution, where everything, you know, went from one to the next step. And so, but they were always really, really small steps. So it took very, very long. Yeah. So I think in architecture, the evolution is way different, but also a very excited one. And maybe at the moment we are in this stage where we need this next step. But I think in order to take this step, maybe we don't need, again, rules of how to make beautiful buildings, or how to make nice forms, or what kind of shapes should define the buildings we are in. I think this time is over. Our generation has much bigger challenges to address as architects. But maybe we need some rules of ethics and moral building.
Evan Troxel of ArchiSpeak and Troxel Podcasts, and Anthony Laney of Laney LA to discuss education, explore architectural software, highlight the evolution of practice, and share the best and worst sides of the business.
It's not to my advantage to bring in their bad habits that they maybe learned in college and apply those to my project, right? So if I can teach them, that's awesome, because I know they're a sponge, because I know they're intensely curious and that they want to learn, right? And I think to me, that's the most important thing that I would want in an employee or in a person who's coming into this field, is that intense curiosity. And to me, that's really what separates kind of maybe even a power user from a super user. Mm-hmm. A super user is really somebody with an intense curiosity, and they're a superstar, because they can learn anything and do anything, and they're adaptable and nimble and flexible, you know, all the synonyms there. But to me, that's kind of what I'm looking for when I'm looking for somebody coming out of school.
I'm open to the fact that it's a broad profession, and so is the architectural education. There is room for folks who think that architecture undergraduate and graduate school is time free to do fantastical, theoretical, conceptual architecture, because that's not what you're doing in the real world. And I'm also open to the idea that college, if it's going to get a return on investment, needs to give the skill sets to be a contributing member to a career, to a profession. Like, people can exist anywhere between those two poles. I'm deeply involved in Teach at USC. I'm deeply involved in a local community college here. They have very different opinions about the profession. I think that's okay. I can cut through all that and say, for my firm, I just need to find people that I want, right? And that's going to be the rare individual, because everyone else is for anyone else. I love what Evan said about curiosity. One of our core values is what we call the detective's curiosity. It is very rare that, I mean, the half-life of information is so brief that anything you learn in school, I just have no hope that you're actually going to use that in my firm.
And Mark LePage of Entre Architect and Eric Reinhold of 30 by 40 Design Workshop discuss product development, remote work culture, living and working on your own terms, and what the future will look like for architects.
So for me, you know, the evolution of practice was really, how do I find the time to design and feel fulfilled with all the things that drew me to architecture? And have a comfortable, reasonable life and still make a profit and not spend, you know, my entire day and night doing it. And the way I did that was to think about, you know, architecture as being split between services and products. And, you know, the services, yes, I still wanted to work with clients one-on-one, very interested in having that engagement and dialogue. But also I needed to, you know, have a larger project so that it wasn't 10 different projects. So larger scale project meant larger budgets, and those clients don't come along every day. So with one project, I need a way to feed revenue into the business that supports just taking on one project. And so that's where I developed this split between products and services. So selling plan sets is a product, you know, educating people online on YouTube, that's a product in a lot of ways. I'm getting revenue from that, you know, putting information out there, sort of information products around the architecture space. So whether that's, you know, how to budget for your project or how to, you know, do board form concrete or a program worksheet or something like that, those products, then, you know, I'm selling those passively and they're supporting my freedom to just take on one project at a time. So I think that split was kind of a critical point in the evolution of my business and my thinking. And I think, you know, in general, the practice of architecture, people are moving away from, you know, working for larger firms and understanding that they want more control over their time. They want to be able to control what they work on and who they work with and how many hours a week they work on a particular project. And, you know, I think building a practice model that splits products and services can support a creative life in a way that just going to an office and, you know, punching in on the time clock for 40, 50, 60 hours a week doesn't. I think there's a, you know, that reinvented practice model is really, it's really been liberating for me.
Yeah. I think that's a huge societal shift right now. With the advent of the internet, we've had this huge pendulum swing of, as well as, you know, the big box stores, everybody's sort of working for this one entity. And we've all reached this sort of breaking point, or many of us have reached this sort of breaking point of, you know, we want to get back to that Main Street sort of lifestyle and sort of get our time back and focus in on, you know, what our passion is and craft certain, whatever that product may be. So I think we're kind of going through that shift back and this sort of transition of people trying to find their way back to kind of what you've been able to create. Mark, you want to add on a little bit with how you kind of approached Entre Architect?
Yeah, and I would just continue where Eric left off. I think that, and what you just said about the societal shift to, you know, small town life and the way we used to live, where, you know, the shop owner lived upstairs above the shop. That was the way it was done. The architect lived above his studio, just like I do now. And that's probably the biggest shift I've seen since I've entered the profession with the rise of the internet. You know, Eric and I started before the internet was really a major piece of what we do. And we saw the evolution of the profession and its effects with the internet on that profession. And one of the things that I've seen and I've experienced is the shift to virtual studios, which allows me to live below my home. I'm literally in a home studio that was built below the rest of my house. And that happened 10 or 11 years after I launched the firm. We started the firm in the basement as part of the basement. Then our firstborn son came along and started crying and realized we can't have babies and kids, you know, babies and architecture in the same environment. And so we moved out to a studio because that's what architects do. We built it out, spent thousands of dollars to have a beautiful reception area and a conference room that we ended up never using. And, you know, worked from a studio in that space for 11 years, spent, you know, close to $5,000, $6,000 a month on rent and expenses and things like that that have run that. But that was the way you needed to launch a studio back then. And then as the evolution of the internet took effect and our society shifted, our lease came up. We said, okay, we're not going to renew this lease. We're going to go home. We built out our own studio. So Anne Marie has a separate studio somewhere else in the house. I have my studio here.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. Hidden. Yeah. She's in the basement.
She's on the second floor in the penthouse. And which is one of the secrets of staying married and staying partners is separate studios, just for anybody who's listening.
Interesting.
So that shift to virtual studios, we sent our staff home too and said, go work from home. They all became independent contractors. To this day, we still have one independent contractor that we work with who's been with us for decades and almost decades. And this is the way we work. And I believe this is the future of architecture, that when architects start, that's the way they're going to start. They're going to start with a laptop or a Revit package or whatever they use. And that's the way they're going to start their studios. You know, it doesn't make sense to launch a studio from an office anymore. No one ever came to my office. It was years and years of expenses that didn't need to be paid. And from the side of the larger firms, that shift is happening there too, although much more slowly, that they have to recognize, because your generation and the next generation that's coming beyond after you is expecting to work from home and to have those flexible hours and to be able to integrate their life with their firm. It's just the way this world is shifting.
So many great insights. I really enjoyed putting that series together and chatting with all the guests, but it was glaringly obvious to me that I left a lot on the table and had an opportunity to take the series format much further. I recently explored this concept with a 10-part series called Going Green, which was quite successful. If you haven't listened yet, it uncovers the untold stories about our environment, diving deep into the complex intersections of energy, environment, and policy to discover groundbreaking innovations and pivotal decisions that shape our future. I'm going to continue this effort annually, examining other specific industry topics. This fall, I will explore housing affordability, tracing housing's evolution from shelter to status symbol, dissect the power players who inflated prices, and exploring solutions to address our affordability issues. Think housing crisis meets true crime story. So make sure to stay subscribed so you don't miss it this fall. Now, I will be taking a break. Yes, another break, but it's to focus on the production for this series. The Spaces feed will stay active with some favorites from the archive. So stay connected and check out some of the great conversations and insights you may have missed out on the first time around. And do me a favor and tell a friend. That goes a long way in helping boost the show. I hope you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane. Thank you for hanging out with me for 200. And here's to 200 more. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit GableMedia.com, and that's GABLMedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.